Blog Talk Radio. Everyone, and welcome to Madame Perry Salon. I am Madame Perry, your host and cruise director for the evening. And just so you know, I got a few announcements. For one thing, we're adding in sponsors right now, and because it's the beginning, you can afford to get a sponsorship on here, maybe a commercial. I can record something for you or just mention you or talk about you, and still be able to live indoors and eat. So give me a call or send me a message here if you're interested. We've had several last few weeks, Mexico Lifestyle Services, Hawks Unite, and we've had Cassandra Webb, an author, also Jay Stock, who wrote Dream Warrior Bears. Very glad to have them here as part of the show. Tonight, my guest is a writer of suspense thrillers. I always say the books he reads. You know, I've had a lot of authors here that write things that just scare the dickens out of you. I've had Laura Benedict, Jasper Bark, Errol Barrow, Emma Audsley, Justin Steele, and I don't know how I got into this group, but they're a lot of fun to be with. And tonight we have author Jeff Crawford. Now I say to me, Jeff Crawford writes kind of it's a thriller, it's a suspense, but it's got a slice, or as I say, a razor slice of paranormal in there. So Jeff should be coming in the studio. I saw him pull up in the parking lot, and I believe he's going through security now. He should be here just a second. Okay. There we go. Jeff. Come on in, Jeff. Jeff, how you doing?
I'm doing just fine now that I remembered to bring some meat and throw out to those wolves.
Oh, you were such a wonderful guest. Thank you. Yeah, I knew. I told you I had a new security system here. So, yeah, they love meat. They don't even care what kind it is. So, you got a brother-in-law sponging off of you? Send him over. We'll never know what. We'll never talk. We'll never give him up. So, I'm glad to have you here. And how are things in? So you've had an interesting tour this year, and like you've been off and on, like you travel and you're back home and travel on these little short stints, plus doing a lot of media broadcast, a lot of interviews. So right now, are you at home in the mountains?
I am. I'm back in Western North Carolina and enjoying all this this fine sunshine we're getting.
Good.
I enjoy going off, but I like being at home just as much.
Yeah, well, you know, I keep saying on here and that I'm gonna one of my goals is to get a big tour bus, like the kind the country music stars have, and put all my favorite people on there, and we'll just have a tour, have a junket, have a tour together. So that wouldn't be so bad, would it?
No, sign me up.
Okay. Don't you worry.
I've got a travel scrabble. We'll go.
Oh, really? Oh, wonderful. Even better. All right. So what I want to talk about is you write like it's a job with a quota to meet. You are... You're the kind of writer fans love, because by the time we finish one, you've got another one. And when I met you, you had just had published through Black Velvet Eyes. But then Faramane, the one just before. You have four books, don't you, published now?
Yeah, I do.
Well, why don't you tell us the names and all about them? You tell it better than me. And tell us, start with the first two, give us the titles and what they're about, and then we'll move up into the new stuff, and maybe if we can sweet talk you, we'll get a little sneak preview of something to come.
Yeah. Okay. the first one I did came out in February of 13, I think. Yeah, February of 13. It was called With Sympathy for Job, and it's the it's a fairly short book. It's a 45,000 words. About I asked myself the question of what's the worst possible thing that a father could have to face, and how would he deal with it? And that's what that book was about. And I had written 8 books up until then, and none of them were very good at all. They were imaginative, and it could have been interesting if I had known what I was doing at the time. But I wrote this next one, and it just sort of, you know, the button finally got pushed, and I figured it out, and I wrote that book and wrote it and edited it in 28 days. And it was done, which is, you know, fairly bizarre. At least in my world it is. And so we put that out, and I had, while it was being typed and cleaned up, I had been working on a second book that I was thinking about putting out. And we did that one. So we put one out February 14th or 13th of 2013. And then I had this other one that we really got on top of as far as editing and proofing and the artwork. And we put it out in June. And I said, okay, we can take a break now. And the second one was The Betrayal, which was a much longer book, about 88,000 words, I think, which is sort of the average now for a novel. And it was about a young man who thought he had the world by the tail and everything that he wanted, and then it all sort of came crashing down around him, and he made a really, really horrible, bad decision that affected not just his life, but an entire town. And you follow this young man for the next couple of years, 3 years, as he drifts in and out and matures. And it was sort of my tribute to Dickens. The whole time I was writing it, I was thinking David Copperfield. And it was sort of a version of that in a really kind of twisted way. So we put that out in June. And while all of that was going on, I was writing religiously 3 hours a night. And I'd had this idea for sort of a supernatural book. And I'd started tinkering with it. And before I knew it, it became a novel. It ended up at 101,000 and change words. And I actually got enough response out of that one to where we decided to put this one out in print. The first two had just been strictly e-books. But we printed this book, and which was really nifty to be able to pick up a book for the first time of my own and look through it. Because I don't read e-books. I love the fact that people do, and I'm glad that the service is there. But I don't like to read them. I like to turn pages. So we put this one up, and I think it actually came out December 23rd. So we actually put out 3 books in 1 year, and I wouldn't advise anybody to do that. That'll kill you.
Good Lord.
we were working, and we put out the next one in April, I think, of 14. And that was through Black Velvet Eyes, which was a radical departure from anything I had done previously. Well, all of them were. They were, nothing followed the same pattern or the same genre. I guess I was groping around trying to find what I liked to do. The first two were a lot of fun because they were post-Civil War and that was sort of my bag. And then I did another one, and it was got into the supernatural thing, which was a lot of fun. And then I wrote a modern piece that was purely suspense, sort of a nail biter. And I wanted to try that, and that's a harder thing to do than a lot of people think, unless you're, you know, a really, really good writer. It, you know, trying to keep people on the edge of their seat without giving too much away at every page. So I did that, and then we started working on another one, and that was March of last year, and we're about to finish that one up in about 2 weeks, and I have never spent 16 months writing a book, but I have on this one.
Oh, my. Okay. So what's the shortest amount of time you spent on a book is?
28 days.
And the longest?
So far has been 16 months.
Wow. Just so far. Wow.
I just don't want to get into the Shelby Foote realm of things where you spend 27 years. But, you know, and as much as he's my second favorite writer of all time, I couldn't imagine spending 27 years with the same book.
Mm-mm.
You
16 months already. That's a lot of relationships don't even last that long. That's a relationship.
Yeah, I've tried to divorce this one two or three times, and it hadn't took.
So, well, let me ask you this. Now, the first two books, after that, and then when you went into Faramane, I want to talk about Through Black Velvet Eyes, and I want to talk about what's coming up next. But Faramane really, really had a special place for me and a lot of people that read it. It's one of the things, I'll tell you what, I guess because when you talk about suspense and the way you write it, and people like you who know how to handle it, it's like it amazes me that you and the other writers like you in this genre, you develop your craft in a way to where you know how to show and not tell, and
that's a tough row to hoe.
Yeah, you show it and not tell it, to where and you know that that's what they're doing. When you get to the point where you're thinking, well, they ought to be able to see that. Oh, okay. You know, that's all right. And, you know, because you feel it's like watching a movie where you're saying, oh, can they see what's down there? Because we can see, but they can't. Or we can suspect. And sometimes we don't even realize. I know that when I read Faramane and Through Black Velvet Eyes, I didn't realize until I think after I had finished the books and thought about them later that I think my thoughts, I feel like I was maybe guided through a haunted house that I wasn't aware I had paid for. You know, when I had suspicions and thoughts and things keep going through my mind and I can see things. I think that's one reason why I like books more than the movies is that, you know, you're given, and why I like songs better than just the video, is that you're given license to let your own imagination take what's given to you in the sounds and in the words and in the descriptions and just go wild and have a field day. And it means what it means to you and you see what you see. And
yeah.
You do that. You've got a slice, you've got a way of slicing it in and out. And then you somehow, just when we get to that part where we think we know, then you snap us out, take us somewhere else. And we're like, whoa, whoa. It's like a little, it's like a smooth. And then the roller coaster part. I love it. So tell me who.
That's the fun part. That for me, that's the fun part. I want to get somebody so emotionally invested that they can see. If you could take a photograph from the inside of somebody's, you know, imagination or in mine and compare them, my characters are not going to look like the reader's characters, but they're going to be similar. You know, and that's. And I don't, you know, it's fine. But if I can get you so emotionally invested that you get to the end of the book and you go, well, that wasn't anything like I was expecting, then, but you're still okay with it, then I'm all right. I did my job. I have my editor, and everybody brags on their editors, and I'm going to too. My editor is great. We usually edit an entire book in about an hour. She's read it. She's made all of her little notes, and I go through and I agree or disagree, and we're done. Because when she gets it, it's very clean. I've already gone through it and left in what I want, and she'll just make little questions or whatnot. But she read this book, the Betrayal. This is an example of what you're talking about. When she read The Betrayal, I called her, and I happened to call her about 2 hours before she was going to finish the book. And she said, I'll call you tonight, and I finish it, and we'll set up a time to go over the notes. And I said, okay. That'd be great, because I always get antsy about the timeline on editing and getting it out. And she didn't call me that night. Well, the next day went by, and she didn't call. And the next day went by, and she didn't call. And so that night, which is, you know, 3 nights later, I called her, and I said, you know, something come up, you couldn't finish the book. She said, oh, no, I finished it in about an hour and a half after we talked. I said, really? And she says, I didn't call you because I didn't have anything to say to you. She said, I didn't call you because I was so mad I couldn't stand to talk to you. I said, really? She said, I got to the last page, and she said, and I was so upset. She said, I understand it, and it was right. But she said, I would never have thought that the book would have ended that way. And I love it when people do that. I don't care if they get mad at me, as long as they were shocked and taken off guard. Because the last thing anybody in the world wants to do is read a book where you know how it's going to end. You know, I can't stand that. So I write books that I want to read.
Well, there's a question there. Because, you know, I write creative nonfiction. I don't write fiction. But I would, as a reader, even if somebody's mad, that's great because you stay on their mind. That means you got there. You know the worm has burrowed in, and won't let go of them. So it stays on their mind. It stays on their mind. And I would think that would be a sign of success.
Oh yeah, you know you read through Black Velvet Eyes.
Oh yes.
My intention and it didn't work out with Faramane. I go into these books with intentions of thinking how I know readers are going to react. Faramane was completely different. Nobody reacted the way I thought they would to that one. Black Velvet Eyes, they did. Everybody was so mad at one of the characters in this book all the way through it, and I knew they would be, and that was the intention. With Faramane, I set out to write a book where nobody in the book, no character, was somebody that you would like. You wanted to dislike this character in this book, and I was wrong. Almost to a T, everybody's come back and that's read that book and said, you know, I took a lot of comfort out of this book, and I appreciated being able to read that. It made me feel good. And I went, what? You know, this is not what I set out to write. Because, you know, we didn't describe that, but Faramane, it was, I looked at the old myth of the ferryman and where you would take a dearly departed and you would put a coin in that person's mouth and the ferryman would come and take them across the River Styx into the next life. And I thought, you know, that's a neat story. But what if there never was a ferryman? What if there had come down and been changed and twisted and bastardized until nobody remembered that there actually was a group called the Faramane that took you from one life to the next. They didn't pronounce judgment. They didn't take you into, you know, and decide how you were going to spend eternity. That wasn't their job. They were just to escort you from this life to that one. So that's where the Faramane came from. And everybody in it, I wrote them as horrible and rotten and bad and ugly as I could. And people still related to characters in there, and just you know, really let it latch hold of them. And it really shocked me on that one. I was not expecting that.
Why not?
Well, I thought everybody would look at it the way I did and say, you know, these are really terrible people, and I'm glad these things are happening. But they didn't. You know, they all say, oh, this person, this was so sad when this happened to this person, or whatever. And I'm, they were awful. Don't you remember what they were like, you know, before this happened? And I have learned not to try to explain my books. I just let people make up their own minds, and if they like them, great. And if they hated the characters, that's great too, because they, you know, you can have as much fun reading a book where you hate everybody as much as you do you like them. So, you know, hey, it's your book. You decide how you enjoyed your time. So that's the way I look at it now.
Well, tell us then, what is the story? What sparked Through Black Velvet Eyes? Because there's quite a difference between the style of Faramane and Through Black Velvet Eyes.
Faramane was still a post-Civil War in Florida, and it was set in the swamps. And I grew up in Florida. I spent 10 years there. I moved there when I was 10 and stayed through my high school years and cowboyed for a while and messed with racehorses for a while and did a lot of things. And I wanted to do a book about Florida, so I did Faramane. And then when I got done with it, I still hadn't got quite over the itch, and I wanted to write another one. So I wrote it in the town where I grew up, and there's a lot of places and events and things, little things in that book that people from Ocala, Florida, will recognize, even though they're not called by name. And so I wanted to write a modern book. I never tried that. So I said, you know, let's just go for broke and do a lot of things that I haven't done. I've never written from most of a book from the viewpoint of a woman, where she was the main character. I've never done anything where the main character was blind. I've never done a lot of things that I did in that book. And it gave me a chance to really think and grope around and stumble and fall and cuss and spit until I finally figured it out. I mean, I really had to think about that one. How would a woman react to this versus how a man would, or how would a blind person do this if she could even do it at all, living on her own? You know, there's, and I don't mean to make it sound like they can't do anything they want, but there's some things will be harder than others. You know, it, down to the simple things like picking out clothes that match. I know people do that every day, but in my mind, I wanted to try to figure out how it was done, you know, or how I would do it if I was in that position. Or would I have to stick with the same canned soft drink, or could I buy different ones and know which one I was going to get when I opened it? You know, so there was a lot of things that gave me a chance to think about. So that's what I did in that book. And I'd been thinking the whole time, what if a blind person could see through the eyes of a painting? You couldn't see all the time, but you could see what was in them. So that's what I did. And then I decided to make it a really cheap black velvet painting that was picked up at a yard sale. And I knew from the time I started that book how it was going to end until I got to the last chapter, and it went out the window, and I said, well, that ain't going to work. That's just too obvious and too stupid. Mm-hmm. So I changed it, and right at the last minute, and I hadn't thought about that for 8 months. I mean, I knew what was going to happen, and then a week before I finished it, it all changed, and I said, well, that makes a whole lot more sense. And I did, and that's how the ending came about. But it's all about and the thing about Velvet Eyes that I don't care how many times I say this, nobody will believe me.
Mm-hmm.
There's two main characters. There's Marley, who is the blind woman, and then there's your husband, Ranger, who is not a ranger, but he was a, well, you have to read the book to find out how he got his nickname. everything that Ranger did and everything that he did was naughty and rotten and just really ugly and bad. But everything he did from the viewpoint that he was trying to do things the right way. Mm-hmm. All he cared about was his wife's feelings. Now, it doesn't show up that way in the book unless you really get into the mind of Ranger, but he really was trying to be a decent guy doing bad things. And I think that's what makes him even more horrible. He didn't come right out and do these bad things and say, well, you know, hang it, that's what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. He was sneaky and sly and trying to be a good guy at the same time he's trying to be a bad guy in it. And I think it just made him just that much more horrible.
Yeah, well, yeah. I can see that.
You want to hate him as much as everybody else did.
Well, yeah, I thought he was, yeah, well, I thought he was an ass. All right, so let's go.
He was, but he wanted to do it in the right kind of way.
He slipped and fell down slippery slope that literally slipped on him.
You know, I don't want to make excuses for him because I wrote him that way, but in my mind, he was trying to do a really bad thing in the really right way. Does that make sense?
Maybe.
All right.
But see, you're talking to a woman that's read the book, okay? From a woman's point of view. No, I see what you're saying. I really do.
Oh, this would be such a great Lifetime movie. And
oh, my gosh, yes.
Girls get together and have a real man bash after this. You know, it's set up for that. The new one, we get to turn the tables a little bit.
Oh, yeah. So you want to go on. I'll tell you what. Give me just a second. This would be a good place to stop and come back, because I do want to talk about the new book you've got coming out and give us a little sneak preview on that. So for right now, I'm going to play, and you know, this is totally coincidental. Joey Stuckey, if you're listening right now, I did not even realize, since we're talking about a blind girl in the story, a blind woman, and so we're going to play the song Blind Man Driving by Joey Stuckey, who is blind, and in the video he carjacks a BMW. So, so yeah, I know. Well, Joey, yeah, I think Joey was on the show a few weeks ago. He's a musician and a producer in Macon, Georgia. Just got back from a tour in England, but he's been nominated in the producer category for the 2015 Georgia Music Awards. So, we're going to hear Blind Man Driving by Joey.
Such a fool.
All right, Joey Stuckey and Blind Man Driving. And let's hope he gives that habit up soon. So, Jeff, did you like that?
Yeah, that's a man that's listened to more than one Buddy Guy and Stevie Ray Vaughan album right there, I guarantee you.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And, yeah, in fact, he's pulled together a lot of people to put together a CD of musicians in Macon for the city of Macon, the Visitors Bureau, to give out as free gifts, the CDs, to people who travel through. So that's pretty cool as well. All right, let me ask you, you're a musician, Jeff, aren't you?
I'm Shade Tree.
Don't
I'm
please.
A Shade Tree.
But I
do like to dabble, yeah.
What do you play?
Music or instrument?
Well, both.
Well, I like to play traditional bluegrass and old country music. I like old, when I say old rock and roll, I mean 60s and 70s. I like bluegrass gospel. I like jazz. I can't play jazz, but I like to listen to it. When it comes to instruments, I play guitar, mandolin, fiddle, banjo, dulcimer, lap steel guitar, some ukulele, about four notes on a piano. But yeah, I like to dabble with a lot of different things.
That's pretty cool. Well, let me ask you this then. As a performer and musician, and I know you play, you know, at different events, and you play with a group of people at church. You've mentioned that to me, like, after on a Sunday afternoon. Does being a performer and a musician affect how you tell stories? And I don't mean maybe just how, well, I don't know, maybe how you write, but also when you're out at events where you read, where you have book signings and personal events where you read and talk to people about your book. Can you see a connection?
You know, you can sometimes, if you're doing a song, whether it's at a family reunion or an all music night at church or whatever, you learn. I think because of the books, I have learned to emphasize the phrasing in a song differently because you want it to tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of straight through or singing it straight through or playing it straight through, you emphasize certain spots the way you would talk. And I think it's done that.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, because I know when now I don't write what you write, but as a singer, because you know I've had my own band and I've played a lot of gigs in Atlanta, and then a lot as well as travel, New York and some other places. I know that a lot of what I did was jazz, but I know some of the standards. Well, I always said my group did the B sides of standards, but when I think of some of my favorite jazz singers, I know that with how Anita O'Day might sing a song, and I've heard some people describe her as, you know, having a sly wink in the way she delivers the lyrics. And then whereas Annie Ross, there's a little bit of attitude, not in a smuggery way, but there's just an attitude that is just enchanting. The way
yeah.
she sings. And then, of course, if the same song done, Dinah Washington, it's just going to come from a whole other place. And it's going to have an emotion, maybe, and even whether it's passion, anger, and it's going to have a different kind of emotion, even though it's the same lyric, same melody, but it's how it's delivered. And
sure.
I know you got, you writers of suspense, you have your way of just using the beautiful language and delivering it in a way that kind of picks up our souls and our emotions and our imaginations and just carries us where you will.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I agree completely with everything you just said. If I want to listen to singers that can emphasize and tell stories while they sing, I listen to Nina Simone or Lena Horne or Uta, you know, Bette Midler, who's, you know, great at that. You know, Bing Crosby is one of my favorites to listen to. And he could emphasize at the right spot and just, he was telling you a story and you forget that he's even singing.
Yes.
You know, so yeah, and you try to do that with, books. I did not do that with the first book, with Sympathy for Job. It was read the first page, take a deep breath, and hang on to something. And it was, you know, it was a Japanese bullet train for 45,000 words. And then you got done, you took another breath, and you said, "Wow, that was really fast and rough." But then I started figuring out, okay, you got to have highs and lows. You got to be able to take a breath now and again. You got to be able to, you know, decompress every once in a while. So I started learning to do that with The Betrayal. Faramane was so, you had so much time to do that in Faramane because you were talking about a period of time that was at about 1900 years from, you know, one point to the last point in that book. So you had plenty of time to think and to breathe and to process. And that's almost all you did in the Black Velvet Eyes. You know, this all happened in a 2-year period, but there was so much thought and inner turmoil and feelings, and only one person of the two knew what was going on the whole time. It was a really deep, that was a you're looking at the learning process from the first book to the fourth one, where I have learned to do that. And the very first book would have made a heck of a Bruce Willis movie, because there was almost no plot. It was all action. And it was a good one. It scared the crap out of people, and that's what I intended to do. But I've learned since then how to, I hope I've learned to write better. I think I have. I think I've progressed in, not matured, but I think I've aged a little better as the book's gone on.
Hey, were you going to read something for us tonight?
Yeah, I can. Which book do you want to hear from?
Well, I got to tell you, you know, every day I plan my lunch at 2:00 so I can have lunch with the Cartwrights. And today, guess who was on there as a guest star? Henry Darrow.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? You're talking about mentally?
Yes, I am.
Not everybody will get that reference. You know, and I wanted them to. I hope they'll go back and look it up on YouTube and Wikipedia and all that stuff. You know, figure out who it really was.
I think, you know what? I think you, like I, will be pleasantly surprised, because I have I created a Pinterest board for Pernell Roberts, but some of the pictures I've gotten from people who have Pinterest boards for what, Bonanza or Henry Darrow or High Chaparral or a lot of people, you know, our age and much, much younger than us. I also have a Pinterest board page for you. You know that. So, I was on there today. I was so surprised to see him. But, so speaking of Henry Darrow, who was the inspiration for the picture, the Black Velvet picture of Manolito.
Right, right. Okay, well, we'll jump into Through Black Velvet Eyes and do a couple of pages. I'll set this up. Marley is living by herself in this little apartment, working a job that she doesn't like. And everything is not going great. going okay, but not great. And then the first really, I'll use a southern word here, the first really queer thing happens to her. And she steps on a coffee cup in her apartment. And the coffee cup should not be on the floor where it's at. So we'll start there.
Okay.
She didn't know if it had been the smoothness of the exterior or the distinctive sound that it made when her toenails had connected with its surface and made that tink that only comes from something hard wrapping it against polished ceramics, or if in all of the almost instantaneous calamity she had somehow discerned the hollowness of the object or had perhaps even felt the telltale handle. However, she had come to the conclusion that she was sure she was right, and now two problems confronted her. One was to find the troublemaker, and two was to figure out why it was where it was when it shouldn't have been anywhere but where it should have been. Had she had some kind of blackout while overindulging on one of those one-pound bag of M&Ms during a horror movie marathon on the classic movie channel that her cable provider provides? More than a few times, she had become involved in movie marathons with a cup of warm tea and a bag of candy for company. Iced tea and a book, or warm coffee and warm coffee and tea, or tea, with a chocolate during a movie was her favorite indulgences. Had she enjoyed one of those all-night sessions recently? She really didn't think so, but couldn't be sure. Would she have been so careless as to leave it sitting where it had been if she had in fact spent all night on the sofa ODing on the fruit of the beans? She certainly hoped not, but at 2 o'clock in the morning, with monsters screeching as a result of being blasted with cutting-edge ray guns and a belly full of chocolate, anything was possible, she supposed. The search for the guilty cup was becoming something akin to a search for a needle in a stack of needles for Marley. It was like these when she wished normal people wouldn't take their sight so for granted. Crawling around on the floor, where after every couple of feet she had to sweep the immediate area with her open hand and outstretched arm to try and locate the mischievous mug, while maintaining her balance with the other hand and periodically checking her temple area to try and determine if the bleeding was growing worse. She was probably just fine and would stay fine if she just quit touching it, but whether you can see the cut or not didn't matter. It was only human nature to feel the need to poke and prod at the injured area. She was more than likely only smearing what little blood there was or filling the small laceration with dust that she was collecting on her hand from crawling around on the floor and feeling under the furniture skirts. Marley knew this, but still couldn't stay her hand from going to the side of her head periodically. The thought briefly crossed her mind to get up and go and clean her temple as best she could and resume her search at some later time, but she just as quickly abandoned the thought and resumed her search. People like her weren't like other people. She didn't have the luxury of going and taking a breather while at the same time scanning the room and area underneath the furnishings for the object that was playing hide and seek with her as she sat in the comfy confines of her favorite chair. Neither did she have the option of telling herself that it was only a cup that she could live without because she had a dozen more that were similar to it and it would turn up at some point. Probably when she got around to rearranging the furniture like she was planning to. No, she had to find it and put it where it belonged. This time she had suffered only a scratch, but next time it could be a lot worse. She wasn't rich and didn't have a multitude of things, but what she did have, with the exception of the recliner and the sofa, had corners and plenty of them. The world of the blind, at least her world, was made up of constant fears, and these were only multiplied by the fact that she lived alone. Fear of choking on something at supper, fear of an intruder, fear of finally giving in to the constant pressure she felt from the darkness that always seemed to be closing in tighter and tighter on her. All these were part of her daily existence, but fear of falling against something hard or sharp or both topped the list that Marley always kept in her head. She was constantly afraid she might one day fall and not only hurt herself so severely that she would need rapid intervention by someone from the medical community, but also that during her fall she might lose her orientation and have to spend precious moments that she might not have just trying to relocate her bearings so she could call for aid. It was slightly irrational fear, and Marley knew it. That sort of circumstance was unlikely if she continued to be careful, and even if she was or wasn't, it could still happen as it did today, but probably not to the extent that she lived in fear of. It did happen. It would be just a stupid accident, by definition, those were going to occur regardless of the precautions she took. That knowledge did not ease her mind, and it never did. You see her groping around on the floor, crawling around, trying to find a coffee cup that shouldn't have been there. And the question that's running through her mind the whole time is, why is this cup here if I didn't put it here?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's bothering her as she lives in this little apartment by herself.
And that's one of our first signs that, not the first, but one of our first signs that something is amiss and something's about to change big time in Marley's world. As if
yeah,
it hadn't already, but again, make
yeah,
another big change.
And it just, yeah, that's right, and it just keeps getting a little worse and a little worse after that.
Well, before, you know, I still want to get into, let me see, I've got a couple of other things I'm dying to ask you. But I want to say, too, for people that are listening, for one thing, if you are listening live right now on Tuesday night, please click the follow there on the screen, and you know that you can call in 646-716-9922 if you want to talk to Jeff Crawford or ask him a question. And Jeff, you're a pretty busy guy. I mean, I know you've got you're going to be on S. Evan Townsend, who's also a fantastic writer. S. Evan Townsend's show this Friday night, which is a speculative fiction cantina. I just love the title of that. And this Saturday, which is June 27th, you're going to be at Joe's Place Coffee in Greenville, South Carolina.
Right. We'll be down signing copies, and I'm looking forward to that.
And it's like a fantastic place. Allie Marshall was there a couple of weeks ago reading from her book, and she was a guest here about 3 weeks ago. But if anyone is interested in knowing where Jeff is going to be, when he's going to be on another show, when he's going to be live maybe in your town, or how to, if you want to get him to your town, you can look up his website is authorjeffcrawford.com. That's author as in writer, not author, but the name, but authorjeffcrawford.com. And he keeps his site up with all his appearances, whether it's broadcast. You've done a lot of touring on broadcast media as well as live, which is one of the cool things about modern technology. You've been interviewed in from the U.S. to Singapore, right?
Yeah. For a gully jumper that's hacking his way through writing to interviews from the local town, and then, you know, from Arkansas to Hollywood and from Georgia to Singapore is a pretty big step, and I've enjoyed it. I hear writers talking about you know, they don't like doing that. All I want to do is write. You know, that may be true, but man, I get a kick out of it. I really do. I love going to book events. I love people telling me everything that they liked or didn't like about the books, except for how they would have ended them different. I don't like that. You know, I always say, well, I'll tell you what, you write your book and I'll read it and I'll tell you how you should have ended it. You know, but other than that, I have a ball. You know, I love meeting people and shaking hands, and I love talking to different hosts. Well, you mentioned the Singapore deal when I did that with Harry Joel, and it was really, really interesting, to say the least. And I'm not sure if I had more problems with his accent than he did with mine.
Like you did quite
well.
I'm not sure. You know, to give full disclosure here, you know, I have to admit on air that I am your publicist. So, but I got to say, whenever I set you, it doesn't matter if I set you up with somebody in Hollywood, who's a playwright and has done TV screenplays, Harry in Singapore. It doesn't matter who I have set you up with for an interview. Everyone sends me back a message immediately saying what a pleasure it was to interview you. And it matters. You know, for one thing, you know, I give webinar teleseminars or webinars for authors for authors and musicians. It's called Promote This. It's DIY publicity. It's teaching people, you know, if you can't hire, if you're not ready to, or you can't afford to hire a publicist yet, you know, take my little two-hour seminar, and it is jam-packed with information. And I always start off with, how can people buy your book or your music if they don't know about it? And they know about it, well, there's several different ways, but you got to get out and talk to people. You got to tell them. And the people that have you on as a guest on a show, you know, they want you to do well. They're looking forward to you being on. And so you have been the best. I've got to say, you have been just about probably the best client as far as the embodiment of going out and trying new things. I've booked you on different kinds of shows, not book review things sometimes. Sometimes it's like Earth Station One podcast, which yeah. I'm sure they would say is just a plain geek fest. I love those guys, Michael Faber and everybody else on Earth Station One. They are so much fun. And they booked you on a show where they're talking about old 60s cartoons. You know, because you've got to get out and meet different people and get to a different audience instead of just one type of people, so they know, you know, you got to sell yourself as well as your books. And you had a good time with those guys, didn't you?
I had a blast with them. It was, you know, that was definitely not in my wheelhouse. But but once I started talking, then I remembered probably 90% of what they were talking about and grew up with it and could join in, and hopefully I was able to contribute. But I know I learned a lot from them, and I had a ball talking with those guys, and you know, I'm looking forward to the next time when I'm with them.
I put another guest on there once about a year or so ago, Jim Musgrave, who's writes suspense, and he writes steampunk as well, mysteries and steampunk. And of course, Jim was writing his element because he taught at Caltech, so it's to him it's like he's hanging out with the Big Bang Theory crew, you know. So he just fit in beautifully. But yes, I'll have to say I always tell you, everyone calls me and says, or sends me a message saying how much they, you know, liked having you on the show to come back. So, yeah, you do. You have to get out whether you want to or not, and that's how you start just, I call it sharing the love. You know, you got to share your book, share the love of your book.
Yeah, I learned right off the bat, just because you've written a book, people aren't going to come banging on your door wanting to get it.
That's right.
Yeah, it took about 3.5 hours for me to figure that one out. I put it out, and it didn't. The world did not tremble when it went up on Amazon the first time. You know, I thought it would, but it didn't. You know, I didn't see limos pulling up from Hollywood wanting to make movies. You know, and I thought, okay, this will happen within a week, and it did not.
Well, you know, and that's why I put together these webinars, because I said, I always get people coming to me that have already put a book out when, you know, you need to start publicizing it. You need to start working it 3 to 6 months ahead of publication. And they come to me after it's over, you know, and I said, well, it's flatlined. Well, when did you publish it? 6 months, a year ago, whatever, and I got no sale. So I thought, well, I'm going to tell people what they can do to kind of backtrack and kind of give it a revival and some life and plan ahead next time. But since you have been, and you've got a few more coming, I'm going to warn you now, I've got plans for other shows in other countries for you. Are your books translated into other languages?
You know, I don't know. I know that option is there with the Amazon and the Nook. You know, it's funny you mentioned that. I was talking to a lady today, a lady that reads my books, buys them usually the first 2 or 3 days they're out, and reads them and can't wait to come back and tell me she loved them. And she's a Hispanic lady with broken English at best. It's not great. It's doable, but it's not great. And I was talking to her. I told her, I said, you know, the new books will come out in the fall. And she says, I can't wait. She said, I'm looking forward to it. And I said, okay. And I started to walk away, and I turned around, and I said, let me ask you something. I said, do you buy your books as e-books? I said, do you get them translated? Because I was wanting to see how Southern dialogue translated into Spanish. And that's what I was asking her for. And she says, I did the first one. She said, I don't anymore. And I said, really? You read them in English? She said, I do. I said, why is that? She said, because it helps me to learn English. She said, I read your book so I can learn English better. And I thought, well, that's neat, but that's a lot of pressure, too, because I write the way Southern people talk, and that may not be good. I'm not sure.
Well, no, it is good, because I read in Spanish, you know, to keep my language skills up, and I like it when I have a book speaking in different dialects or different people's way of speech in their community or whatever where their region, because it helps me. If I just read in like a textbook Spanish, it wouldn't help me. But I've got somebody talking real street slang or somebody speaking, you know, some more Elizabethan, it's good. You're doing more good. And you know what, Jeff, I'm so sorry. His next book is Field of Ghosts. And let me tell you, if you're not scared yet by his other books, you're going to be scared at Fields of Ghosts. And, Jeff, they're telling me now my airtime is about to cut off. I am so glad you were here. Folks, go to authorjeffcrawford.com. Find out what Jeff's going to be. Jeff, you want to say goodbye to the nice people and tell them you'll be back?
Yeah, I'll be back anytime you want. It was a pleasure being here. Follow me on my website or on Facebook, and for whatever you like it or don't, leave a review somewhere on the books for mine or any other any author. Leave a review.
Definitely leave a review, Jeff. We're going to have another time together on the air because I just love talking to you, and I would love sharing you with the world. And so this has been Madam Perry and author Jeff Crawford, who's just going to scare the bejesus out of you here on Madam Perry Salon. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
Goodbye, Luda.